This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Last summer, 14 members of an elite team of firefighters were killed as they battled a blaze that had engulfed South Canyon, Colorado. Winds of 50 miles per hour turned a controllable fire into an inferno that overran the firefighters, scrambling to escape its destructive path. Peter Leschak is a freelance firefighter who works out west fighting wilderness fires. He's part of a team of foot soldiers who work on the ground, performing a kind of hand-to-hand combat with the blazes. This is seasonal work since big western forest fires only happen when the weather is warm and dry. When Peter Leschak is not fighting fires, he's at home in Minnesota, where his other seasonal work is writing. His books include Letters from Side Lake, A Chronicle of Life in the North Woods, The Bear Guardian, Northwoods Tales and Meditations, and his newest, Hell Roaring, The Life and Times of a Firebum. He writes that what attracts him to fighting fires is both the madness and the fellowship. I asked him to describe the madness.
Well, I guess there's an anecdote that might clarify that. Back in 1989, for instance, I received a phone call in the middle of the night as, you know, you're rarely ever dispatched at a reasonable hour. And the dispatcher here in Duluth actually asked me if I was willing to go to a forest fire in California, and I said absolutely. And I showed up at the airport at the appointed hour, and the plane took off, and we landed in Boise, Idaho. And, of course, everything had been changed in mid-flight, and the beauty of it is you never know what to expect. It can be a totally chaotic environment. And, of course, uncertainty is the spice of life. It's the only thing that makes life interesting, actually. And so there's always that suspense, what's going to happen next. You wake up in Minnesota, you go to sleep in Wyoming.
I would think, though, that there's nothing ambiguous about fighting a forest fire.
Actually, there is quite often an ambiguity there. You know, on the face of it, you know, I guess we've been told by Smokey Bear and you know, you name it, the culture in general, that fire is an evil thing. And that when you are combating fire, you are fighting this evil entity, which isn't the case at all. For instance, there is always a measure of, well, not always, but quite often, a measure of doubt. Should this fire be put out or not in the wildland environment? For instance, Yellowstone in 88, as anyone who's around will recall, was this huge a media event, and of course the tenor of the coverage was, you know, we're losing our national treasure, and it became a huge political football. And there were 10,000 of us firefighters there for about 2 months, and frankly, if there had only been 5,000, the outcome would not have been different at all. And in retrospect, the fires, more often than not, had a positive impact on Yellowstone. A lot of the ecosystems around this nation, most of the forest ecosystems, are fire-dependent.
Well, explain to us the kind of equipment you need, you take into fighting a big fire. I mean, for us city dwellers, we're used to the fire truck pulling up, attaching to the local fire hydrant, and spraying it with water. When you're out in the middle of the wilderness, what do you take with you?
Well, you know, there are a lot of variables there. It depends on where the fire is. A big part of wildland fire, unlike municipal firefighting, is that we use aviation resources quite a bit. You see a lot of helicopters. You see a lot of air tankers. Those are the huge twin-engine or four-engine aircraft that dump retardant on the fire. And one of the things that continues to amaze me after all these years is the huge logistical problems that you run into. You know, as I mentioned, we had 10,000 firefighters at Yellowstone, and keeping those people fed and equipped can be just a monumental task. And it depends on what branch you're in. If you are doing helitack, that is working with helicopters, or if you are with an engine crew using fire engines that would be fairly familiar to city dwellers, or whether you're on a hand crew, which I do quite often. It's a 20-person crew, and you go into the fire, hike in, or flown in via helicopter with hand tools, shovels, an axe-like tool called a Pulaski, and basically dig. You dig fire line, or you grub out burning stumps. Perhaps there's a water source, and you haul in hose, and you fight it with nozzles. A huge tool of firefighting is ignition devices. You know, you fight fire with fire. The old the old proverb, and you can do that by dropping fire, literally napalm, out of the sky, or you can do it with handheld tools called fusees or drip torches. And of course, chainsaws are a huge item on fires. But on a hand crew, you spend a lot of time hiking. In fact, I've often looked at some of these Western fire details as sort of a paid camping trip to keep the morale up.
Is there a kind of hierarchy in the firefighters who put out wilderness fires?
There is a hierarchy in the Forest Service. I suppose at the pinnacle of that hierarchy are the smoke jumpers. Those are the people who parachute into wildfires, generally small wildfires. There's only about 400 of those people in the entire country. Next comes what they call the hotshot crews, and they became a little more well-known as a result of the Storm King Mountain fire in Colorado because there was a hotshot crew that was involved with that fire. And these are 20-person crews who, at least theoretically, have more experience and are at a higher level of training. Then you have helitack crews. These are firefighters assigned to helicopters who are delivered to the fire via helicopter and support the helicopters. And then you have what are called Type 2 crews. These are hand crews, 20-person crews, who are at a lower level of experience and training. So there is a pretty definite hierarchy there.
And the hand crew, these are the people who hike up the mountain. And
these are the people you see in the news reports who are basically almost always digging. When you really get down to the nitty gritty, it's sometimes very unglamorous work. And sometimes, you really get excited to get the fire dispatch and you get all your gear together. And 24 hours later, you're somewhere you've never been before digging fire line and wondering why you were so excited.
Well, explain to us what it's like to approach a big fire in a forest. I mean, let's imagine you're hiking up a mountain and you're approaching this fire. What do you smell? What do you see? What do you hear?
Well, if I'm going to be really true to my profession, what I smell is money. We are very, when you're totally dependent on the weather and when you're dependent on what is amounts to seasonal work, you find it difficult to be upset at the notion of a fire. And, sometimes we feel ourselves somewhat out of sync with the general public because they're being told this horrible, horrible event is going down and all we see is a paycheck, some adventure, and some travel.
And you make pretty good money, do you not?
Oh, not at all. In fact, I'm sure most middle-class Americans would be appalled. For instance, when I go out on a hand crew, my basic wage is around $8 an hour with no overtime and no hazard pay. And the only thing that makes it even remotely worthwhile financially is the fact that you get, you rack up perhaps 300 hours in 3 weeks. And the pay is low, partially out of tradition, because during the Depression days, there was a phenomenon called job hunting. And, of course, times were tough, and people realized that if they went out into the woods and started a fire, that the Forest Service or the BLM or whoever would be looking to pick up some firefighters. That's what they used to do in the old days. They would basically empty the saloons or the highways or whatever and send people out into the woods to fight fire. And so a ready source of income was to go light one up and get on the payroll. As a result of that, a lot of agencies deliberately kept firefighter wages low. And they got into the habit of bringing crews from as far away as they could to discourage the local people from lighting up the woods. And so that tradition has sort of carried over. A lot of people are shocked to learn that smoke jumpers, I mean, these are the elite. These are the people who parachute, into forested mountains, which is just mind-boggling. And they are very well-trained, highly skilled individuals who risk their lives just about every day. And most of these people are getting $9 or $10 an hour.
So it isn't the smell of money, it's the smell of hard work?
Well, there is a lot of hard work. There is travel. There is adventure. And, of course, the money is significant. I wouldn't do it for free. But the federal government might be spending a lot of money in a lot of areas, but they're not spending it on firefighter wages.
Well, let me ask you, because I set my kitchen on fire about 5 years ago and pretty much burned it up. And once I got everybody out of the house, I ran back into the house to make sure I'd gotten all the animals out. And I went into my kitchen, which is just the average size kitchen, and the cabinets were all on fire. I mean, the whole thing was on fire. It was so loud. And I'm trying to imagine what the sound of a huge forest fire must be like.
Well, last summer, I was in Washington on a hand crew. It was the Tyee Fire, which was one of the biggest ones last year. I think it finally made it to about 127,000 acres. And The conditions were so extremely dry, and the fire behavior was so outrageous that we were being literally pushed all around by that fire. And at one point, we were on a dozer line, a line that had been gouged out by a bulldozer, and we were basically improving that line. And we were unaware that there was some fire building below. And the classic description of it as it builds and it races up the mountainside is of a jet aircraft. Mm. There was no mistaking that sound, and it really is quite a horrible sound when you understand what's coming up the hill at you. And it can be incredibly loud.
Are you afraid when you're fighting a big fire? Are you conscious of being afraid?
Sometimes, most of the time, I think the fear comes beforehand. As I sit around in the wintertime thinking about the things that have been or the things that could have been, I think you get a lot more nervous then. When you are directly involved, and if you are at a certain level of training and experience, you're usually just too busy to be directly concerned with the notion of fear most of the time. And, obviously sometimes panic can be a part of it. But most of the time you're just too busy. And then afterwards, you kind of sit down and you think about what might have been, and then perhaps you start to get a little shaky.
Well, I want to talk more about fighting fires, but first we have to take a very short break. My guest is Peter Leschak, and he's a traveling freelance firefighter, and he's written a book about fighting fires in the American West. It's called Hell Roaring, The Life and Times of a Firebum. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with firefighter Peter Leschak. Are fires predictable in any way? And I'm thinking about the difference even between a fire started by lightning and a fire started by humans who were irresponsible with a campfire. Does it make any difference how a fire was started in its effect on how it burns?
No, the determining factor is, there are so many variables, and of course weather would probably be the chief one. I mean, what's the humidity? How dry is it? How windy is it? What are the slopes? One reason that there are so many huge fires in the West is because of the component of slope, and slope is basically artificial wind. And so fires move very quickly and furiously, upslope. It depends on where it was started. For instance, if it was started near homes, the response is going to be a lot more aggressive, perhaps, than if it's just out in the middle of nowhere. But, a fire ignited by any means is basically the same. I mean, unless someone was to use some sort of incendiary means and spread a lot of fire along a wide front. Here in the East, and to a certain extent in the West, you get a lot of railroad starts where a long train with perhaps what they call hot brakes is throwing off sparks, and you can have a train set afire, continuous fire for miles. And then, of course, you're into a very serious situation very quickly.
Is there a most dangerous aspect of a fire? I feel almost silly asking this question, but I'm thinking about smoke. I'm thinking about the actual fire itself. I'm thinking about falling trees. I'm thinking about trees that even explode from the heat. Is there something that a firefighter has to be most vigilant about?
Well, you mentioned one of them that we worry a lot about, and that is falling trees, or as they're known in the trade, snags. And a snag is any dead standing tree. And of course, if a particularly hot fire rips through some forest, it's going to leave a lot of snags behind. And I remember one night at Yellowstone, we were supposed to go into a stretch of burned out forest there and do some mop up. That is, clean up the remnants of the heat. And it was windy that night, and we could literally hear the trees falling almost constantly. And so we just didn't even dare go in there. The particularly wicked things about a snag is that it can fall almost, soundlessly. It can just pull out of the ground. The roots are burned off. The soil has perhaps been disturbed, and it can just tip over without a sound. And there's not much you can do about that. I mean, if it sort of has your name on it, you're all done. And I know a lot more firefighters who have been seriously injured or hurt by snags than, say, have been burned to death. And if you look at the statistics, the casualty and fatality statistics, another big killer is vehicle accidents and aircraft accidents. And relatively few firefighters are actually killed by the fire. Last year's incident at Storm King was probably an exception.
What about the grizzlies and snakes that wait for you at the camp?
Oh, yeah. You know, the animals are always a concern. And in fact, there's some pretty bizarre things have happened over the years. For instance, at a fire in California, I think it was in the late 40s, a burning marmot ran across the fire line downslope and ignited a fire below the firefighters and killed several of them. You know, and that doesn't happen terribly often, but it's one thing you keep an eye out for, a burning rodent crossing the line. And of course, you better stop it if you see one.
Are you aware in a big forest fire that animals are being burned to death?
Yes, but it doesn't happen as often as you would imagine.
Really?
At Yellowstone, for example, you know, is probably some of the most outrageous fire behavior of the century. I suspect it's the biggest fires I'll ever see. I mean, it looked like the end of the world. When the North Fork fire blew out on Black Thursday, we happened to be in a helicopter just north of there. And as I recall, the smoke column reached up like to 50 or 60,000 feet and flattened out and made its own lightning. I mean, that's how huge of a column this was. And it ran like 14 miles and it burned up 40,000 acres in an afternoon. And yet, in spite of that, I think that the animal casualties, say the elk casualties at Yellowstone, numbered less than 200. You know, animals get out of the way. I mean, especially if they live in a fire ecosystem, they know what it's all about, and they get out of the way.
What's the most dangerous situation you've ever found yourself in a fire, where you really felt this was it?
One was at Yellowstone in 88, and I detail it in the book. We ended up, because of the shortage of hotshot crews, the Type 1 crews, most of them were in Alaska that year. And of course, that tells you something about the Yellowstone politics, because although Yellowstone was definitely a serious and huge fire, there were bigger ones in Alaska in 1988, but nobody cared. So because of this shortage of hotshot crews, our crew, which is a Type 2 crew, which was considered of lesser ability, was put into positions we would normally not have been. And we were at the head of the Hunter Fire near Shadow Mountain in the Bridger-Teton National Forest, and came as close to being overrun probably as I would care to be in those circumstances. And the fire came right up to our line, and several trees exploded in just huge showers of sparks, like a blizzard of sparks, and they just rolled right over our heads behind us into very dry grass. And so we had two crews there, basically 40 people, and we were just on our hands and knees just grabbing these embers in our gloves and snuffing them as fast as we could, realizing that if we missed even one, you know, that had the chance to turn that whole meadow into fire, and we would be in a very poor position.
What is the effect of women firefighters? And as you write about it, there are more women firefighters who are showing up at these big forest fires.
Yeah, there has been, particularly in the federal organizations with affirmative action programs, a lot more females are showing up on the fire ground. And, you know, in fact, I ran into a crew back in Idaho in 89 that was completely made up of female Alaskan natives, and although they did have a white male crew boss, and we kind of gave them some kidding over that. But my attitude toward female firefighters is that they are just like the males in that there are good ones, there are bad ones, and there are so-so ones. And I hope that I do not have a particular gender bias. To a large extent, and this is another huge attraction of the fire ground, to a huge extent it is a meritocracy because one, you can't hide out there, and two, a lot of people simply aren't willing to put up with incompetence because there's so much at stake. So a lot of people who don't belong out there, or at least in my estimation don't belong out there, weed themselves out. You know, they come there for a season or half a season, and they're gone.
Do you have any permanent scars, aches, and pains based on fighting fires?
Well, on a structure fire a few years ago, I tore the cartilage in my knee, and of course, that was a surgical operation, and most of my injuries are from other things and are simply aggravated by fire. Since I am now going to be 44 in a real hurry, I can't fake it anymore, and so, you know, unlike the 22-year-olds and the 24-year-olds, I have to work out constantly, and I do it year-round. In the winter, for instance, I try to put 500 miles on my cross-country skis. I continually do stretching exercises and strength-building exercises. You know, the best strategy is always to prevent it.
Well, the fire season is starting soon. Are you getting itchy?
Oh, yes. I've been sort of primping my gear already, and
Waiting for the phone to ring?
Yeah, here in Minnesota, we're still pretty much into winter. We had, in fact, a snowstorm just the other day. But when we get into March, the snow starts to go, and generally our fire season here is April and May. And yeah, I have to admit, I'm really looking forward to it. I heard a long-range forecast the other day that said we might have drought conditions, and I have to admit to a little perverse glee.
Have you ever gone back to visit a site that burned just to see what it looked like? You mentioned Yellowstone earlier.
Oh, yeah. In fact, one consequence of fire here in northern Minnesota, if it's in the right ground, is that sooner or later it may create a wonderful blueberry patch. And when I go looking for blueberries in the summer, if I happen to be around, it's something I really like to gather, I go back to the old fire sites, and that's where I might find the blueberries. And one thing that has really impressed me when I go back to places where I have fought a fire is the rejuvenating power of fire. I mean, that's why it is such a huge part of the ecosystem. Fires are natural fertilizers of the forest, and forests as we know them, you know, could not exist without fire. And, you know, we have really upset that balance because we have come in with, you know, huge logging operations and all sorts of other forest management practices. But probably the original forest manager in most cases was fire. And for instance, in northern Minnesota, we have the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. It's a 1.2 million acre wilderness area. And I've done some research on that. And before the white settlement, that whole area burned over on the average of every 120 years, except for the wettest bogs. Since white settlement, we have upped that to every 2,000 years. And so in one way or another, we have had a huge impact on that, or will have a huge impact on that ecosystem by keeping fire out of it. And I'm not sure that anyone knows how that's going to turn out.
Well, I wish you the best of luck, and I thank you very much, Peter Leschek, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you, Marty.
That's Peter Leschek, author of Hell Roaring, The Life and Times of a Firebum. I'm Marty Moscoane, and this is Fresh Air.